Agenda Radio, a weekly hour of African American political thought and action.
Welcome to the radio magazine that brings you news, commentary, and analysis from a Black Left perspective. I'm Glenn Ford, along with my co-host, Nellie Bailey. Coming up, President Obama claims he wants to call off Washington's perpetual war against people all over the world, but his plan is a secret. Meanwhile, the war against Syria continues, and a continental conference convenes this week on the ongoing armed occupation of Haiti.
But first, the U.S. imprisons more people by far than any nation in the world, most of them black and brown, and at least 80,000 under conditions of solitary confinement. The Stop Mass Incarceration Network has scheduled a series of actions for next month. Network spokesperson Carl Dick says U.S. torture of prisoners is top of the list.
Well, what we will see in June is an effort to bring forward nationwide resistance to torture in prisons, because there's actually a lot of news right now of the fact that the U.S. tortures prisoners in Guantanamo, and that is a deserving and much-needed revelation of a horror. But what people also need to know is that there are 80,000 people locked down in prison in the continental United States who are held in conditions that fit the international definition of torture. And in fact, they are held consciously in conditions that are driving them insane. You know, locked 22 plus hours a day in a tiny windowless cell, denied access to sunlight, often denied human contact for weeks, months, and even years at a time, held in soundlessness for long periods of time. These are conditions which eat away at somebody's sanity, and it's the conditions for more than 80,000 people in this country who are in prison. This is unacceptable, and it must be stopped, and there is going to be a drive to stop it. This is connecting with the fact that some of the prisoners, those in the California segregation units, have declared that they are going to restart the hunger strike that they suspended back in 2011. They're going to do that on July 8th. And the Stop Mass Incarceration Network has decided we're not going to wait for the people in prison to restart the hunger strike and put their lives on the line. We're going to start building support for this fight now. We have put out an emergency call to stop torture in the prisons, which we are circulating for signatures, and we're going to be spreading that all across the country. And we have called for days of solidarity with the fight to end torture in prisons on June 21st through the 23rd. On those days, there are going to be protests and rallies in cities across the country. There are going to be evenings of conscience. Our religious leaders are going to be challenged to address this torture in their sermons to their congregations, because people have to really, one, we have to open people's eyes to the existence of this widespread torture. And then on the basis of doing that, challenge them over what kind of human beings do they want to be. Are they going to be people who are going to sit by and watch people be tortured in the name of their safety, and falsely in the name of their safety, because this torture doesn't make anybody any safer? Or are they going to find their humanity and demand that it stop?
80,000 people, and it could be as many as 100,000 people. That's equal to the size of a major U.S. city. In human history, has there ever been a situation in which a nation held that number of people, anything approaching that, in solitary confinement?
Solitary confinement? No, the U.S. is a world champion when it comes to imprisoning people in general. They lead the world in that. And they are also the world champions in solitary confinement. No country has ever done that. And people really need to know this. You know, the U.S. goes around the world wagging its finger at other countries about human rights violations when they are actually committing human rights violations on a scale that is unprecedented in world history. And this is something that we're going to be working to drag into the light of day. It's going to be an especial challenge because at the same time, the trial of the vigilante murderer of Trayvon Martin opens in June. So we're going to have to play the piano here because there need to be national outpourings on June 10th when that trial opens, because the only reason Zimmerman is on trial in the first place is because people spoke out nationwide, and the only shot to win justice in that case is if the outpourings of rage at the murder of Trayvon Martin continue. So the Stop Mass Incarceration Network has called for a hoodie day on June 10th, which we're going to build as we're building support around the fight to end torture in prisons.
You made reference to Guantanamo, a place that President Obama claims he wants to close. Under his plan, the Guantanamo prisoners would have been located to a new prison in Illinois. Now that prison, it's still being built, and it will become a supermax full of prisoners, hundreds of them, in solitary confinement.
Yes, see, because that's something that people don't know. The U.S. was building these torture chambers before they even had a war on terror, and it was aimed initially at people imprisoned for revolutionary activity in the 1960s, and frankly, to come right down to it, the government did studies on soundlessness, no human contact, other forms of sensory deprivation, and concluded that such conditions could break people, could cause them to lose their sanity. And they initially put those conditions onto political prisoners and prisoners of war from the 1960s, and then began to make it a regular tool in the confinement of thousands and tens of thousands of prisoners. So that's how that developed. That's how it got to Guantanamo, but it spread very widely here in the U.S. even before there was a detention camp in Guantanamo.
It seems that the use of mass incarceration and mass solitary confinement is intended not just to break individuals, but to break whole movements and whole populations.
Yes, that's actually a very important point to make, because what mass incarceration is it is a concentration of the oppression that's brought down on black people. You know, because the folks that run this country remember the 1960s, and they remembered how black youth spearheaded the development of a broader revolutionary movement that rocked the whole system back on its heels. And they do not want to see that happen again. And how they have gone at that since the 1970s is skyrocketing numbers of people in prison, wars on drugs, wars on crime that are only waged in black communities and then following that in Latino communities. And at the same time, they suck the jobs and other legitimate ways to survive out of those communities, flood them with drugs, gear the educational system to fail our youth, and then sweep up large sections of youth into prison. So that's what we're dealing with. And then once you're in prison, there's the widespread use of torture in the form of solitary confinement as a mechanism of control for the prison population. So what is being hit at here is that large sections of the black and Latino community is caught up in this, because when a brother or a sister goes to jail, they don't go alone. They take the hearts of their family with them. And one thing that has happened off of this is that some of the people who are strongest in the fight against torture in the prison are the family members of some of the imprisoned people who have been participating in conference calls and meetings and other forms to organize resistance. And we expect that to be a very significant feature of the Days of Solidarity on June 21st to the 23rd, the statements from these family members about what's being done to their family. And through that, people can get a sense of the way in which the larger community as a whole is being targeted through these policies of torture and repression. People who want to get information on what's being done around the fight to stop torture in prison and how they can get involved need to go to the website of the Stop Mass Incarceration Network, and that is www.stopmassincarceration.org. That's Stop Mass Incarceration, all one word, no punctuation, www.carldix.org.
That was Carl Dix speaking from New York.
President Obama made what the White House is calling an historic speech, claiming to have a plan to someday end the perpetual U.S. war against targets all around the globe. He says he signed a new policy on drone warfare and targeted assassinations, but the guidelines remain a secret. Obama asked Congress to make changes in the laws that authorize presidents to use deadly force against those thought to threaten the United States, but he had no suggestions on what those changes should be. We spoke with veteran anti-war activist David Swanson, who publishes the influential website War is a Crime.
Well, as you know, Congresswoman Barbara Lee has a bill to repeal the authorization for the use of military force, that of 2001. Nobody tends to mention that there are two of them, another one from Iraq in 2003 that for some unearthly reason remains on the books as well. The president did not support that legislation or anything like it. He said that the authorization for the use of military force should be refined, whatever in the world that may mean, but it sounds like changed while kept in place. And I cannot imagine it being changed in a way that I would approve of. The danger is that it's going to be changed in ways that make it even worse. And then eventually it should be repealed, you know, just as eventually the world should be without nuclear weapons. That doesn't mean in Obama's term as president or in his lifetime or in this century. It means eventually. And so my view is that's not good enough. Why wait? You know, why not repeal this madness now?
The corporate media is reporting on his press conference as if he actually wants a return to pre-9/11 legal status. But that was before we had all of these layers of so-called anti-terror law. And we don't see him making specific proposals to get rid of that whole body of legislation.
Well, there was some nice rhetoric, and for people who like rhetoric, it was a great speech. There was nothing concrete in it anywhere, and if you look at the White House website the day after the speech, the president has essentially posted a new constitution. I don't know if the states are going to have to ratify it or if you and I are going to have any say in it, but he's posted on the White House website the criteria he will impose on himself before he murders anyone with a missile from a drone. And presumably, if you want to interpret it that way, before he kills anyone with any technology whatsoever. So this is the president saying in that speech and in this document, I've been killing people I shouldn't have been. I've been being too reckless with who I kill. But accountability, consequences are off the table. You all should be satisfied that henceforward I am going to impose stricter criteria on myself, and I hope that future presidents might do the same, and I'm going to meet those criteria to my own satisfaction, and the evidence is going to be secret. And so he asserts that he met his self-imposed criteria before murdering Anwar al-Awlaki. There is no public evidence of that whatsoever, nor is there any for the other three Americans, who we are to presume were killed by accident or by signature strike. To the American that whose name they didn't mention until the day before the president's speech, they effectively told the New York Times was killed by signature strike. This is, of course, a missile strike on someone whose name is not known, much less who has met all these criteria that the president claims each victim should meet. Nor does he mention in the speech or elsewhere the strikes that have been used to target rescuers of victims. Nor does he mention the countless children and women and seniors that by no stretch of anyone's imagination meet any of these criteria of being continuing imminent threats to the United States and senior operational agents of Al-Qaeda or associated groups and so forth. By the president's own confession, what he's been doing for years is an unacceptable outrage. But there's no revelation of the facts, and there's no discussion of consequences. And he's now proposing to continue and to apply these outrageous self-imposed criteria with no court oversight and no legislative oversight to non-Americans. These criteria that he's only applied to Americans thus far, supposedly, he's going to now apply to non-Americans as well in certain countries. You know, and now if you or I were on a murder spree or any other criminal spree, we could not announce that we were going to limit our crimes in certain countries but not others and have that be satisfactory to anyone.
It seems as much a codification of an outrageous violation of international law than a step back.
Absolutely. You have some interpreting, you have an article in McClatchy interpreting the new language as probably signaling an increase in the use of drone strikes. You have others taking the president at his word that there will be a decrease in drone strikes. You have a long article in the Politico newspaper, which I happen to have in my hands. I have the misfortune to be in Washington, D.C. at the moment, reassuring everyone that drones will continue to be a booming business, with one little paragraph at the very end where our friend Medea Benjamin, who interrupted the president, points out that these drone kills are making us less safe, not more safe, which is not rebutted. It's just not relevant to the overall importance of profitability. But what you don't have is any elimination of the policy of murdering people with missiles from drones or any other technology, nor do you have any proposal for making this operation public, for oversight by courts, for oversight by Congress, any discussion of the ongoing UN investigation of these operations as a crime, any consideration of whether the other 75-some nations that now have drones should engage in the same behavior the United States does, or how to respond when they do. This is an ongoing outrage in which a king is saying, I am going to behave slightly differently. And it's to the credit of activists that he had to say anything at all. And it's to the credit of the one activist in the room in which no reporter asked a single question that the president heard some outrage and some serious questions on topics he didn't touch. This is a president who this week admitted to having killed four U.S. citizens. I don't know that any media outlet whatsoever has asked him how many human beings he's killed. It just hasn't come up.
Yes, the whole subject of the legality of the U.S. position doesn't come up much in corporate media. What of the almost infinite number of kill lists that other nations could put together as they identified people and groups and countries that they feared might present an imminent threat to their security? What about their right to act in kind?
It's not a right I support, but it's a right that follows logically from the U.S. practice and now somewhat U.S. stated policies and beliefs. When Italy convicts, as it has, 23 CIA agents for kidnapping a man in Italy and sending him off to be tortured, and those agents are living free and easy in the United States and they're not extradited, should Italy have the right to target them with drone strikes in Colorado and Florida and Virginia, or should it not? When the United States threatens the nation of Syria, as the president did in that speech, in the next breath after talking about U.S. support for democracy around the world, should the nation of Syria have the right to respond to that threat? When the United States threatens Iran with war in violation of the U.N. Charter, should Iran have the right to respond with drone strikes on the U.S. military in Arlington? I don't think so, but it does follow logically from U.S. claims of rights to go after anyone, anywhere. The president claims in his new laws that he himself has drafted and posted on his website that he will respect the sovereignty of other nations. But there's no evidence that this is the case, and there's no mechanism for any of these criteria to be enforced by anyone other than the president himself.
David Swanson, speaking from Washington.
The United States has agreed to meet with Russia and others for talks on the war against the government of Syria. Washington continues to claim that it is not sending weapons to the so-called rebels, although many of its allies in the region are supplying arms and equipment, and Israel has stepped up its attack on Syria. Sarah Flounders is with UNAC, the United National Anti-War Coalition. She spoke to us from New York.
The U.S. is today very, very deeply involved in an all-out effort at regime change against the government of Syria, and absolutely in arming, getting military equipment, providing supply bases, surveillance, all manner of materials and very open about it. It's not a secret, even while there's this, quote, plausible denial. But the arms are flooding in through Saudi Arabia and Qatar very openly. And the bases operate in Turkey, a 60-year NATO member. And who is NATO? It's really the U.S. military-commanded alliance. There are 14 U.S. military bases in Turkey, along with all the NATO bases and so on. And who's Saudi Arabia and Qatar? These are really corrupt, feudal regimes held in control and in domination by U.S. power, U.S. bases, and U.S. equipment. So the very equipment and material they have, that Saudi Arabia and the Qatar has, comes directly from the U.S., is funneled through them into Syria. So the U.S. is also heavily involved in special forces operations operating in Jordan. And, of course, there's Israel. We can never forget the role that Israel is playing, because a whole part of Syria is occupied territory in Golan. And just 2 days ago, Israeli missiles again hit Syria. The Syrians hit an Israeli military jeep that had actually crossed the ceasefire line in Golan directly into Syria, and Israel responded with missile fire. And, of course, there was a bombing just 2 weeks ago from Israel, again, all U.S. supplied. So it's all the proxies in the region, whether, of course, Israel receiving $4 billion a year of U.S. aid, supplies, and support, or Jordan, another feudal, corrupt regime, a complete dictatorship, or Turkey, the home of so many NATO bases. This is all a U.S. and Western operation to totally recolonize Syria, completely destroy the nationalized property, and also it's a war on the entire region. It's aimed at Lebanon, it's aimed at Hezbollah and the forces in Lebanon that have been able to have some independence for Lebanon, free from total Israeli occupation. And it's also a continued war against the Palestinian people.
And involving precisely the same actors as launched the air assault against Libya 2 years ago.
Exactly, exactly. And when you look at what's happened in Libya today, in 7 months of bombing, really, U.S. NATO forces made Libya a free fire zone. Anything that moved on the ground was bombed. The beautiful, magnificent cities of Libya, modern cities, completely destroyed, including the electric grid, the water, the schools, the hospitals. Libya today has no functioning government, which is really just fine with the major oil corporations. They don't have to worry about paying anybody anything. The oil continues to pump from giant platforms in the Mediterranean just off the Libyan coast. And for the people of Libya, nothing operates any longer, including the most basic social supplies, backup network, whether it's schools or health care or potable water. And the billions of dollars that Libya had very generously extended throughout Africa for development of many, many countries has now stopped. So today, throughout Africa, AFRICOM and U.S. forces in 35 African countries, that's the result of the destruction of Libya, and that's exactly what they want to do to Syria. It's part of a regional war, just as Libya was part of a war against the whole continent of Africa. The war in Syria is targeting Iran directly, and as I say, targeting Libya, targeting Palestine, targeting any effort of independent development, any form of nationalized property which is used for the benefit of the people themselves, any form of labor legislation that exists. What U.S. corporations want is what they have in Bangladesh, is a race to the bottom and a complete destruction of the governments that had been able to secure some guarantees and some contracts with Western corporations for development.
So the United States shares and makes common cause with the hereditary aristocracies of Qatar, the Emirates, and Saudi Arabia in the destruction of secular states in that region.
That's exactly. It's important that to recognize that really Syria is the last of the secular Arab states left standing. And instead, there is an alliance with the most reactionary religious forces. You could look at Iran, that's also a religious state, but on an entirely different basis than what exists in Qatar and Saudi Arabia in the Gulf states, where there's absolutely no rights for women, where the great majority of the population are undocumented immigrants throughout the Gulf states who have no rights whatsoever. They're not considered citizens. They don't have a right to anything at all. So when you look at who there's an alliance with, it's the most reactionary regimes that Western power, really, U.S. and British imperialism, set up these monarchies. These aren't long-standing regimes. They're an actual creation based on the oil wealth to find a small, tiny sliver of collaborators. Saudi Arabia, named after the Saud family, who have benefited as multi-billionaires, one family, while for the overwhelming majority of the population, no rights whatsoever.
And in Qatar, that's a country with only about 250,000 indigenous population. The working population, all from outside of the country, is 10 times as large.
That's absolutely true. The population is 10 times as large, and it's a population completely without any rights whatsoever, any form of participation, and any benefits from the state in terms of the most basic health care. The 95% of the population of Qatar, no rights whatsoever. It's also important to know that the Qatar has no military of its own, not even a fictional one. So the idea that Qatar is shipping aid, military aid to Syria, is a complete myth. This is U.S. arms that just come down the pipeline. And it's important to understand that in terms of what Qatar is and how it exists as a base for, you know, U.S. military air command in the entire region.
In the early stages of the conflict in Syria, the United States said it was necessary for it to lend support to the opponents of the government because they were the good guys. They were the Democrats. Now we hear the argument that there must be intervention because there are some bad guys among the rebels, these Islamic fundamentalists. It seems, therefore, that all of the avenues of U.S. policy lead to intervention.
That's absolutely true, because in the beginning, it is important to realize that all kinds of forces were swept up in the promise of big changes coming in Syria. And Syria, as any country that's on the absolute front line and under years of Israeli and U.S. pressure, there is a hunger for change and openness. But very quickly, people realized this is all about regime change. This isn't about democratic opening. This is about losing everything that we have. And this is about losing a secular state where there are many, many small religious and national groupings within Syria. They also stand to lose. And who were the forces coming in? Overwhelmingly outside forces organized from around the world, mercenaries, death squads, and extreme religious forces. There was a very interesting statement made by Sheikh Nasrallah from Hezbollah stating that what was U.S. policy was to destroy some of the very fundamentalist religious forces that they're at war with around the world by sending them to Syria to be used against the regime there, that it was a dual policy and the most cynical possible.
And what of the role of U.S. and European-based so-called human rights groups? Have they been neutral in the conflict in Syria?
Well, there are a number of human rights groups that are not really genuine human rights groups anymore because of where the funding comes from, who their directors are. I point especially to the role of Amnesty International here in the U.S., which has become really a spokesperson for U.S. State Department line, headed now by a former State Department personnel who has used Amnesty International to speak for NATO involvement in Afghanistan and U.S. wars around the world. So in the name of human rights, this is really can be an extension of U.S. and Western imperialist policy, as totally different from real and alternative organizations fighting against war and fighting for real human rights that come from below. But the large funded organizations are completely tied to funding from corporate power in the U.S., Britain, Germany, and France. And every one of these organizations functions in that way. They attract to them very well-meaning people who often want to make a difference, but the direction, the money, and the senior staff really reflects corporate power's interests.
And all of this destruction, Libya 2 years ago and now Syria, takes place under the banner of humanitarian intervention.
Very much so. That's what it's called, and that is what the war in Yugoslavia was called, where you had 3 months of 70-some days of U.S. bombing completely laying waste to the country, total destruction and occupation of Kosovo, carving it up into pieces, seizing the mines and the resources of the region. That was another humanitarian war. Had nothing to do with humanitarian at all, as the war in Libya had nothing to do with humanitarian interest in democracy. Any of the forces that the U.S. is supporting have no links to the struggle for real or fundamental change. They're not involved in fighting for people's rights or people's needs. It's the most extreme forces and also literally paid mercenaries who go wherever there's war and will fight for the dollars. And so you have an intense level of corruption. This was also true in Iraq. It's true in Afghanistan, where sometimes two-thirds of the forces in the field are private contractors who just are fighting for the dollar, absolutely ruthless and brutal, and shoot anything that moves, and do so with complete complicity of U.S. military.
And we must include Haiti in the humanitarian interventionist list as well.
We certainly must, because Haiti is really one of the best examples of a U.S. orchestrated coup. Then they handed it over to a U.N. military administration to administer Haiti. Thousands, more than 10,000 U.N. troops in Haiti are literally government at the point of a gun, establishing an election where Aristide or any chosen candidate of the people can't run. And the people held under a form of military occupation, all in the quote-unquote humanitarian interests. And when there's a natural disaster, such as there certainly was in Haiti with a giant earthquake, none of the money is forthcoming. It all goes to these humanitarian organizations who ride around in great luxury and have been unable, even years later, to provide the most basic supplies to the population. And Haiti is also a good example of a long memory of the ruling class in the U.S., a country built on slavery. They never forgive Haiti for being the first country, the first revolutionary upheaval of slaves that succeeded in history. And this is true when you look at where they're targeting, the countries they're targeting. They want to destroy the very memory that the people themselves can vastly improve their own life, organize themselves, govern themselves. That's what they wanted to destroy in Libya, such a small country. But the very idea that people could use the oil wealth for their own development and for the development of the whole continent of Africa, they want to wipe that out. They want to wipe out in Syria, and they also want to destroy it totally in Iran, the social gains that have come unevenly, not perfectly, because these are all governments under endless attack, but where there has been huge steps forward in protective legislation, where there is a state that decides contracts. They don't allow just a free-for-all for the oil and resource corporations and huge labor corporations that just are plying the world looking for the cheapest labor. So the coup in Haiti, the coup in Honduras, the attempted coups in Venezuela and Ecuador and throughout Latin America, that's another form of U.S. power. Sometimes it's direct military bombs, and sometimes it's using a policy of sanctions and CIA operatives to attempt to dominate the planet. And here in the U.S., it's very important to take sides in these struggles and to always point the finger at what Wall Street and what Washington is attempting.
That was Sarah Flounders of UNAC, the United National Anti-War Coalition.
Labor and human rights activists from a host of countries will converge on the capital of Haiti this week for a continental conference to demand that United Nations troops cease their occupation of that country. Alan Benjamin is with the San Francisco Bay Area Labor Council and an organizer of the conference in Haiti.
It's been convened by a series of organizations in Haiti. It's a broad coalition has come together, Haiti Liberté, a number of the trade unions, the collectives, and a lot of grassroots organizations, supported by unions and community organizations across the continent, from the Brazilian Trade Union Federation, CUT, to a wing of the Brazilian Workers' Party. The issue of Brazil is major because Brazil is serving as the proxy for the U.S. French-led invasion and occupation of Haiti that deposed the president, Bertrand Aristide. And there'll be unions from Argentina, from Mexico. Jubilee South has endorsed. It's a very broad-based coalition, and it's come together with the sole purpose of organizing a continental-wide fight to withdraw UN occupation troops from Haiti. They've been there since the coup that deposed Aristide in 2004, and they are occupation troops there to impose repression on a people that have refused to accept the violation of their sovereignty, of their right to determine their own destiny, to elect their own president, to be able to protest, to have their own leaders. So it's not very much on the radar, unfortunately, as an occupation. It has the mantle of the UN and so-called legitimacy as a stabilizing force as opposed to an occupation force, but it's very much that, an occupation.
In 2004, when the United States troops that were occupying Haiti were replaced with UN troops, the mandate was supposed to be for 6 months, and then there would be elections, and folks assumed that the troops would be departing soon, but they've been there almost 10 years.
That's correct. It was a six-month mandate. The level of deceit is just something that's unheard of. You even had the Senate in Haiti, and you should know that all of so-called elections since 2004 have taken place, banning the Lavalas party from participating at all times, a party that by all accounts has 70% to 80% of the popular support. So what kind of a democracy is that? You have even that Senate elected in these conditions, voting in 2011 that all UN troops should leave Haiti by 2013. And the so-called elections that brought Martelly to power, a right-winger linked to the old Tonton Macoutes, he's refused to convene elections, even according to their own undemocratic laws. It was supposed to renew one-third of the Senate earlier this year. He's canceled those elections. He's canceled municipal elections. And, of course, the people have said enough, enough, enough. With the cholera, with the fact that who knows where the money went to rebuild after the earthquake, more than 500,000 people are living out in tents in squalid conditions. It's an outrage. And Haiti, the brave people, the first to have fought off Napoleon's armies and defeated imperialism, are being made to pay that price and to suffer. It's outrageous, and we believe that it's the responsibility of all people to stand by Haiti and the Haitian people for their right to determine their own destiny.
The United Nations has refused to take responsibility for that cholera epidemic, which has killed thousands and infected hundreds of thousands. Much of the initiative for this conference in Haiti comes from Brazilian sources. Well, how did Brazil become the biggest contributor to the occupation and basically recognized as the lead country in the occupation of Haiti?
You're absolutely correct. 8,300 deaths till this date by cholera infestation brought in by the UN Nepalese troops polluting the Artibonite River. 670,000 people have been sickened by this disease. Many, many will die because of it. And yet the UN in February said, we're immune from this. We will take no responsibility. And that fight continues. Brazil. Why Brazil? Well, it's a little bit the case of Tony Blair in Britain. Lula offered his good offices the credibility of a president that emerged from a mass working-class party and a mass uprising at the end of the 1970s, and who progressively moved more and more to the right and gave Bush, and now Obama, the cover to serve as a proxy force of occupation. Most of the troops, the large bulk of the troops stationed in Haiti are Brazilian, and the MINUSTA troops are under Brazilian command. And that's why there's been a very strong campaign, including within the Workers' Party, by deputies, by council members, just organized recently a tour of Senator Jean-Charles Moïse of Haiti to help organize and build support throughout Brazil for this conference, but also among, of course, the Black Unified Movement and the Black activists across Brazil have risen up in support of Haiti, to the main trade union federation, the CUT. So there are huge contradictions even at the level of the government over this. But the Workers' Party government of Lula and now of Dilma are solidly behind this intervention occupation and they're huge responsibility for the deaths and the repression and the violence being meted out against the people in Haiti.
The mandate for these occupation troops is to bring stability, but Haiti is not unstable. What are they there for?
Well, they're there to protect U.S. multinational corporate interests. The outrage in all of this is that Bill Clinton, who's the real overseer, the de facto president of Haiti, is dictating the policies in the country, and there are now three different versions of what's called the HOPE Law, H-O-P-E, which is all about the platforms for investment. And Haiti is now being rebuilt as a sweatshop pass-through industry for textiles. Much of the processing is done initially in China and is being reassembled for export to the United States in these sweatshops, in the special economic zones in Cap-Haïtien. There are three different zones now. And the unions there, Haiti has a long history and tradition of union organizing. The unions have been banned. There are various unions that are seeking to organize. So one of the campaigns of the conference, of course, in addition to withdrawing the UN troops and reparations for the victims of cholera, is the question of full labor rights, full rights to organize. So that, I think, is a major one. There's no insurrection, but more and more anger today at the occupation troops. Any small opening to be able to mobilize, you have thousands of people in the streets demanding justice. An important delegation from the United States will be attending. Sister Nellie Hester, who's, if I'm not mistaken, a co-host with you of Black Agenda Report Radio, Sister Colia Clark, and Sister Suzanne Ross from the Mumia Committee will be attending, as will Kim Ives from Haiti Liberté. They'll be joining the estimated 150, 160 delegates who will be there from countries all across the hemisphere and some in Africa and Europe who will be attending also as observers. And Sister Suzanne Ross will be bringing a message from Mumia from his prison cell in Pennsylvania, greeting to the conference and supporting the demands of the conference and thanking the tens of thousands of Haitians who over the years have supported the call of the committee for his freedom. And so that will be a very important moment at a rally, a mass rally that will be held the first afternoon of the conference on May 31st.
That was Alan Benjamin of the International Liaison Committee of Workers and Peoples.
In addition to disastrous climate change, the spread of urban slums and proxy wars fomented by outside powers, Africa now faces a land grab not seen since colonial times. One such scheme in Cameroon allowed a multinational corporation to lease 73,000 hectares of land, that's about 180,000 acres, for 99 years at only $1 per hectare a year. The Heracles Farm palm oil plantation has been temporarily halted after massive complaints of fraud and broken promises. Greenpeace International and the Oakland Institute called a press conference to denounce the Heracles Corporation project. Oakland Institute Executive Director Anuradha Mittal explained.
Heracles has marketed its plantation as a long-term development project to address food security and provide employment and social benefits in Cameroon. However, the company's value driver documents reveal that Heracles actually estimates the land for which it will pay just $1 per hectare per year to be worth $4,500 per hectare, and that the company keeps the option to exit as early as 2017. Although Heracles' financial model lacks credibility, these projections confirm its intention to make huge profits on the transfer of an asset it acquired on the cheap. In conclusion, the acts of Heracles Farms, though particularly egregious, are not an anomaly in the world of green investments and should serve as a reminder that the land rush by foreign investors into African nations is not driven by any philanthropy, despite claims to the contrary. It is time to call on those who initially bought into Robel's multi-tiered facade of the perfect sustainable investment that promised mega returns to help the Cameroonian people free themselves from Heracles' greenwashed snare by demanding accountability. This is not a rebuke to the very real efforts to bring infrastructure or development to Africa. However, Heracles Exposed serves as an imperative for the international community to proceed only with the understanding that Africa is open for business, not for theft.
That was Anuradha Mittal of the Oakland Institute. Greenpeace International Brendan Swartz also weighed in on the land grab. He said the palm oil plantation would actually underdevelop Cameroon.
I wanted to add just one comment and another reason why Greenpeace has been following this project so closely is the public manner in which they have tried to frame the debate as this is a development project and Heracles is pro-development. Thus, anyone opposing the project would be anti-development. And in fact, in some of the work that Greenpeace has sponsored with Cameroonian NGOs and local communities, small-scale farmers who are already producing cash crops such as cocoa and then other food crops in the area are making far more independently operating than they would as laborers in Heracles plantation. So we believe the net effect of the project would be creating unemployment and underdevelopment. And we also feel, I personally feel very sorry for investors that Heracles has been able to convince to put money into this project. They have an operating model which is extremely unrealistic, and they're promising returns of up to 40%, internal rate of return of 40%, and a 10 times return on capital invested to these investors. Meanwhile, they're using very questionable legal practices on the ground, which could mean that the entire investment itself is at risk. And so one of the messages, one of the takeaways, is that investing in land in Africa is very risky, especially when companies don't take the time to conduct due diligence, to consult communities, and seek the proper approvals to move forward.
That was Brendan Swartz of Greenpeace International.
African Americans have voted in record numbers in the last two presidential elections, but their votes count for less and less in local elections because state and appointed authorities have been taking more and more power from localities. Many black politicians call the usurpation of local power racist. Black Agenda Report managing editor Bruce Dixon says that's certainly true, but simply saying so is no solution. He made this commentary on the latest edition of Black Agenda Television.
Detroit, Michigan, and suburban Atlanta's DeKalb County, Georgia, each have about 700,000 people, and both have black majorities. DeKalb at 55% and Detroit with 83%. They have something else in common as well. In both cases, financial emergencies, fiscal crises have been declared, which have allowed under new state laws, local elected governments to be swept aside. In both Detroit, Michigan, and DeKalb County, Georgia, black and white elites together have declared these fiscal crises. As Rahm Emanuel, the mayor of Chicago, says, the elite never want a perfectly good crisis to go to waste. So the local elected governments in DeKalb County, Georgia, the school board, and in Detroit, Michigan, City Hall itself have been set aside by state law so that the governor can appoint stooges to impose massively unpopular programs of austerity, wage, pension, benefit, and service cuts, and privatization. Quite simply, what austerity regimes do is they turn local government from an entity which collects local taxes and fees in order to pay its employees living wages to provide needed services into a machine which collects local taxes and user fees from the poor and sends them straight to Wall Street as interest payments on an eternal, unpayable debt. Our black and white elites tell us that this is because Detroit, Michigan, and DeKalb County, Georgia, and hundreds of other cities and towns, state governments, and even the federal government, which prints its own money, have allowed spending to run out of control and have for some time lived beyond their means. The truth, however, is that local, state, and federal governments long ago stopped taxing the property and incomes of the wealthy, preferring to concentrate on the smaller property and smaller incomes of working people, making up what they should have got from taxing the rich by borrowing from them at interest. To make matters worse, our black and white elites bargained in bad faith with teachers and government workers across the country to avoid granting immediate wage increases to city, state, and local workers like those in Georgia, Michigan, Illinois, and every place else. They agreed to pension and benefit hikes, effectively money later instead of money now. But since they would not raise taxes on the rich, they never actually had that money to put in those pension funds. And now, very soon, those pensions will be due. We noted that both Detroit, Michigan, and DeKalb County, Georgia, are majority black. Several smaller cities in Michigan have also been placed under emergency rule as well, so that more than half of Michigan's black population now live under unelected governments. And in Metro Atlanta, the second greatest concentration of African-descended people in North America, DeKalb's fate is a sword hanging over the majority black city of Atlanta and neighboring Clayton County as well. Is the whole thing racist? You could say that, but you wouldn't be explaining much of anything. Georgia's governor halted the appointment process of his stooges to demand more black representation. The Wall Street lawyers selected to shred and privatize what remains of Detroit is black as well. Both Georgia and Michigan have long-standing, well-entrenched black representation at all levels of government and among the jackals who want to sell Detroit's water system or the land beneath DeKalb schools for a dime on the dollar. Telling each other how racist it is, even suing in court for discriminatory impact, is worse than a waste of time. It's actual misdirection. But it's the best and the only explanation, besides the phony spinning beyond our means nonsense, that our black political class has to offer. In truth, unelected austerity governments might well be racist, but that doesn't tell us how to get rid of them. So it's not really useful information. The useful truth is that it's capitalism. It's disaster capitalism. It's vampire capitalism. Capitalism that turns everything into debt, and capitalism in which some of the bloodsuckers have black faces.
And that's it for this edition of Black Agenda Radio. Be sure to visit us at blackagendareport.com, where you'll find a new and provocative issue each Wednesday. That's www.blackagendareport.com. And while you're there, check out the latest episode of Black Agenda TV. It's the place for news, commentary, and analysis from the Black Left. I'm Glenn Ford, along with my co-host, Nellie Bailey. Our thanks to the good people at the Progressive Radio Network, and especially to our engineer, Greg Russ.
This is Black Agenda Radio, information for liberation.